This is the last day of this December 2008 four-day session. And we'll finish up with our text called Zibo, the Last Great Zen Master of China, translated by J.C. Cleary. We left off yesterday in the middle of a letter from Zibo to one of his disciples, presumably. He goes on, "There are three kinds of not awakening: confusion due to views and thoughts, confusion due to the multiplicity of sense objects, and fundamental ignorance. All who have blood and breath are guilty of these three. That's why they do not attain to the path of the sages." Well, this is an interesting breakdown of ignorance or confusion. Confusion due to views and thoughts. This is arguably the most difficult confusion to unseat. Views and thoughts, because we have so many of them. We've picked up so many notions, concepts, views, opinions, and which have become woven into us, deep into our tissues, so much so that many of them we're not even aware of. We just imagine that we're seeing the world as it is, that our perceptions of reality, our views about the nature of people and reality and oneself and others, that's the way they are. But the longer we practice, the more we peel away these veils of acquired notions and see them as that. We come to discover that these are just things we've picked up, and that they are filters that mediate our apprehension of reality. Confusion due to the multiplicity of sense objects. I think this is self-explanatory, the way that we're constantly being caught by sights, sounds, feelings, smells, tastes, and thoughts. Or here maybe just means the five senses. No, it probably means all six. And then the last one, fundamental ignorance. What is known in Hinduism as advicca, not knowing, meaning not knowing the nature of things, not knowing reality. It's from this not knowing that arise we call the three poisons: greed, anger or hostility, and delusion or confusion. Sometimes the third poison is translated as confusion. So he says everyone has these three, and that's why it's so difficult to awaken. He goes on, "They do not penetrate to inner truth. They do not fuse phenomena. And they do not get the subtle wonder of the path. If they penetrated inner truth, they would comprehend wherever they go. With fusion, no phenomena could obstruct them. With subtle wonder, they could encompass emptiness and existence without getting entangled. In this way, ready-made, subtle function would be complete in each and every one. This subtle function is how we would all conduct our lives were we fully enlightened. This reference to fusing phenomena I read as samadhi, seeing through the illusory duality of things. Seeing that there is no thing outside us. And when we see that there is no other, nothing outside us, then obstructions and impingements of every kind disappear. We get an experience of this in deep absorption in our practice, where we get beyond thought. When we get beyond thought, then we see how all phenomena are no other than our own mind, our own nature. He goes on, "We people today have a tremendous accumulation of good and evil. The mountain of self and others is high. When things go against us, we are angered and displeased. When joy and anger are born, the substratum of luminous awareness is obscured. Once this pedestal of awareness is obscured, when we see form, we are deluded by form, and when we hear sounds, we are deluded by sounds." Fragrant and foul, sweet and bitter, rough and smooth, the shadows of likes and dislikes, these are all forms of knowledge generated from sense objects. Since the knowledge is diluted, it goes wrong. Going wrong, it moves away from reality. The one round light is fragmented into the six consciousnesses. Once it becomes discriminating consciousness, it judges the body to be the self. There are these eight levels or modes of consciousness in Buddhism. The first five are the ordinary senses. The sixth is the sixth sense of thinking or perception. The seventh is that which interprets the data of the six senses, including thoughts. This seventh is the seat of the ego I. Our experience of the six senses, and the sixth includes thoughts. These in themselves, having thoughts, would not be a problem. It's when we then step back and conceptualize about any of the five senses or thought. So a single thought popping into the mind, if we left it alone, would be no problem. That's the nature of this organ that we call the brain, is it generates thought activity. So they bubble up. The problem comes when we then attach to the thought, and we then from that issues and a second thought, and then a train of thought, and then we're off and running. Those interpretations or conceptualizing, that's the work of the seventh level of consciousness. The eighth is that which is beyond all this. He goes on, deluded by sexual attraction, increased by desires for food and drink, the waves of sentiment flood out, washing you along into impermanence. This creates all sorts of evil manifestations in the skull's cave of false imaginations. The sky cannot cover them. The earth cannot bear them up. Tied up in the dark for eternal ages, changing physical shape, rising and sinking through myriad forms, the bitter suffering is indescribable. If people are bitten by mosquitoes, they squirm around and are not at peace. If they hear of this suffering and their minds remain unmoved, can they be called the most luminous of beings? Well, this language is such that it's difficult to know exactly what he means, but I don't think we need to know exactly. He's talking about the all of the suffering that we bring on ourselves through this incessant thinking and separating ourselves from others, separating ourselves from the direct experience of these senses. Through this process of conceptualizing, we come to find ourselves in a world of conflict and quarrels, of anxiety about all of the things that we get anxious about, fears, enemies. We generate this world through our minds, by misusing our minds, by not knowing how to use our attention. We get caught in this net of thoughts of self and other, us versus them. Ultimately, war. Next letter, and this is to a man who was sick at the time. It's about the value of adversity, or when adversity, of course, meaning difficulty, things that are going against us. The workings of mind have no constancy. Controlling them is up to the person. If you control mind with the power of the path, you do not pay attention to success and profit. If you control mind by means of success and profit, you do not pay attention to humanity and righteousness. Tracing back what they start from, though they proceed differently, neither the power of the path nor success and profit is beyond one's own mind. The divergence is in what the will is placed on. Some words come to mind. This is a master who once said, when thoughts of the way are strong, worldly thoughts are weak. When worldly thoughts are strong, thoughts of the way are weak. We can't have it both ways. If we want to dwell in thoughts about how we can acquire more and more, whether it's wealth or power or mates or anything else, material goods, status, spiritual status, this is all in the realm of worldly objects of mind. The more we give ourselves over to these things, the less we can use our attention. This is the key element of our minds, the key to evolving or regressing spiritually. We can only put our attention on one thing at a time. And to repeat, if you control mind by means of success and profit, if you let those things dominate your mind, you do not pay attention to humanity and righteousness, to matters of compassion and caring and giving. Another way to say it is, to the degree that our minds are absorbed in self-interest or self-concern, there won't be anything we have for others. And then self suffers as well as others. And all of this, this whole choice of where we place our attention, is something that we face moment by moment. And in Zazen, we see it most meticulously, second by second, millisecond by millisecond. What is our choice? Our choice is between going with the thoughts or going with no thought, no mind, the breath, the koan. And we are faced with that choice over and over, maybe hundreds of times in a single minute. And our experience of life and reality, relationships and work, all of that is determined by how we choose to direct our attention. He goes on, when the power of the path controls the mind, is when we refrain from giving way to thoughts, everything is a stepping stone, even being robbed and mistreated. When success and profit control the mind, everything is a cause for alarm, even glory and honor. When causes of alarm disturb the mind, the spirit is always troubled, all the more so when one is robbed or mistreated. Thus, a person studying the path, or practicing, let's say, a person practicing considered it the best luck to be in unwished-for situations. If one does not awaken amidst this great good luck, but rather floats along pursuing objects, this is called dimming the mind. A person whose mind is dimmed, even if in daily contact with sages and saints, is no different from a blind man who thinks it's the dead of night even though the bright sun is above his head. Thus, he's saying, a true practitioner considers it the best luck to be in unwished for situations. How many people can honestly say that they consider it the best luck when things go against them, when they can't get what they want, when they want it, how they want it, when they have to face people they have difficulty with, working with people they have difficulty with, dealing with injury, sickness, loss. How many people can see that as fertile territory for spiritual growth. And of those who can maybe manage to see it, can understand why that would be good for spiritual growth, how many really welcome it? So although we may not be able in adversity to feel good about it, we do have the ability to reflect, to step back and recognize that when this is all fuel for deepening our practice and getting underneath the surface of life. And then he says, if one does not awaken amidst this great good luck, meaning the difficult circumstances, but rather floats along pursuing objects, this is called dimming the mind. This is where good fortune really becomes its opposite. And we see this on a national scale of our own country. The Dalai Lama famously said, America has perfected samsara. We have managed to create a world with almost unending sources of pleasure, comfort, diversion, entertainment. And other industrialized countries are catching up. But we have gone about it with a vengeance to try to eliminate any kind of discomfort, pain, uncertainty, insecurity. Of course, we never will be able to do that. That's the nature, that's the first noble truth of life is unsatisfactory, life is ultimately frustrating. But we can waste a lot of time just coasting along with everything going our way, able to gratify our many desires, sense desires and others, and getting a lot of what we want. All right, it is unrealistic to ask anyone to not try to maximize their happiness. Of course, who would not want that? In fact, practice itself is a way to find contentment. But what we can do when we're facing painful circumstances, painful relationships, change that is painful, is we can reflect and find that this is all grist for the mill. Things we can work with, things that will develop our character, if not awaken us. Floats along pursuing objects. This is called dimming the mind. Thomas Merton once said that he pointed out that the more you try to avoid suffering, the more you suffer, because smaller and more insignificant things begin to torture you in proportion to your fear of being hurt. Most of the peoples of the world would shake their head in amazement at what we people in these modern industrialized countries, what we consider adversity, pain. There's nothing wrong with responding to circumstances that pleasurable or enjoyable circumstances and resisting painful, trying circumstances, except for one big thing. We become attached to having things our own way. We become attached to having things our own way. And then when they go otherwise, as they, of course, inevitably will, then we suffer all the more. So Buddhism is we're not trying to suffer more. We're trying to suffer less. That's what this is all about, of course. The Buddha said very simply, I teach but two things, suffering and the end of suffering. But what seems to be in our favor in any given moment, then in the long run turns out to turn against us. He goes on, generally, if you just don't deceive mind, mind of itself is luminous and wise. Using the luminous and wise mind, when you are placed in unwished for situations, they are like remnants of snow naturally melting away in spring. It doesn't take crashing thunder splitting the earth open to disperse them. So the more we can move along with change and with circumstances as they are, the more we can accept things as they are, the less we will suffer up the road. This is also can be understood in terms of our likes and dislikes. There's nothing wrong with having likes and dislikes as long as we're not attached to them. When we get attached to them, then we put ourselves in a corner, and then we just set ourselves up for misery. You're asked by the flight attendant, do you like a beverage? Yes, what do you have? Well, we have Coke, Diet Sprite, ginger ale, cranberry, orange, dum. Then imagine someone saying, well, don't you have Dr. Pepper? Well, no, we don't. Oh, you don't? No. Oh. Apply that in 1,000, 10,000 ways to all of our choices as consumers. We're way out on a limb. We're like Wile E. Coyote out there in space. We have created this habit of getting what we want. And it's not a doomsday perspective to see that we're not going to be able to do that a whole lot longer. The Book of Poetry says, it's a particular text, it's capitalized here, the stone of another mountain can be used to cut jade. And then he goes on, if you use jade to cut jade, forming a vessel is exceedingly difficult because both are smooth and rubbing them together has no effect. Thus, when you are placed in a desirable situation, mind and situation are both forgotten. Since you forget, you lose awareness. Even if you have a strict teacher or spiritual friend to give you illuminating instructions most conscientiously, you nevertheless foster the habit of overfamiliarity. Thus it is said, adverse situations are a spear in your face. Favorable situations are an arrow in the back of your head. And then he comments, the spear in your face is easy to dodge. So, in other words, the spear that you're facing, the spear you're facing is easy to dodge. The arrow in the back of your head is hard to defend against. Moreover, the worldly way is more and more in decline. For a long time, the tradition of enlightened teachers has been decrepit and moribund. Strict teachers and spiritual friends are not easy to meet. If you are able to use unwished-for situations as your teachers and stepping stones, wherever you go, there are strict teachers and spiritual friends. So eventually, even if we get away with just following the path of least resistance, having everything our own way, eventually, of course, it catches up to us, certainly at death. We run into our limits. But before then, usually sickness, deteriorating health of every kind, and so forth. Finally, he says, this is all to a sick monk. Emotional consciousness floats and sinks. The four elements are added on and ripped off. If you can let the light of wisdom appear alone, empty and peaceful, you return to the source. Though the old sticking points are there, if you do not encourage them, how can they do harm? The old sticking points, all the ways that we trip ourselves up, all the ways that we bind ourselves in our likes and dislikes. But if we don't indulge ourselves in these things, these habits of thought, then they really don't have any power over us. With one mind unborn, being and nothingness are not in opposition. Much less is there a perceiver. Even so, once one mind is born, the six sense faculties are already provided. It is not possible to have entry into enlightenment by abandoning these. So, of course, there's no way that we can ever get outside our senses, the six senses. Well, we don't need to. This true nature is beyond the six senses, but it is not apart from them. In the Diamond Sutra, it says, if you try to see Buddha through form and color or through sound, you cannot. You're going the wrong way. You cannot see Buddha. Buddha nature, let's make it. And he goes on, this being so, all things are the marks of the Tathagata's long, broad tongue. There's a footnote there. The Tathagata's long, broad tongue, originally one of the 32 auspicious marks of the Buddha, this came to be taken in a broader sense as symbolic of the universality and infinite multiformity of the teaching of enlightenment, all of the ways that the truth can be expounded, the truth can be revealed. He goes on, sad songs, deep feelings, swearing and chiding, thorn forests and trees of beauty, gowns and caps, rites and music, drums and flutes, drinking, eating, sex, right and wrong, good and evil, the clash of weapons, the formal dance, silent misty forests, noisy urban squares. Whether one has entry or not depends on how one hears Buddha's tongue in all these forms. Our aim in Zen practice is not to escape the world, but to enter into the world so fully that we become one with it, and in our oneness with it, we transcend it. And this means, of course, within the limits of the precepts, which just describe our enlightened mind. There is it's very common among those of us in spiritual practice to have the impulse to escape from the world, to what is broadly considered the annihilation side of human desire. The Buddha broadly differentiated the two human impulses, two different types. One is to be attached to things of the world, and the other is to seek the annihilation or the disappearance of the world. Those who have ascetic tendencies, who are very introverted, who avoid social environments, who avoid ordinary worldly things, are in one direction. They tend to flee from the world, and then probably more common are those who go the other direction, get attached to all of the pleasures and delights and of the world. This is really what the Buddha meant by when he called his teaching the middle way, where we neither become attached to the world nor recoil from it. I think this is a good stopping point. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.